Welcome, everyone. Well done for getting here in spite of tube strikes and all the rest of it. Great to have you with us. My name is Marcus Nodder. I'm the senior pastor here at London's Floating Church, St. Peter's Barge. A special welcome if you're here for the first time. So this is the first in a series of talks through November called Question Time. And today we're kicking off with Has Science Buried God? And we're very grateful to David Wilkinson for making the trip all the way down from Durham this morning on the train and somehow getting across London to get here to be with us today. So thank you very much, David. I'm going to hand over to him now. He's going to speak for 20, 25 minutes, and then there's a chance for questions from the floor. Thank you.
Thank you, Marcus, and it's good to be here. Thank you for having me. Thank you for giving up your lunchtime to come to this kind of event. I got on the train this morning and was reminded a little time ago of getting on a train, and the person beside me introduced himself and then said, "And what do you do?" Well, I said, I teach theology at Durham University and I'm a Methodist minister. His eyes suddenly filled with fear as he thought to himself, "Oh no, all the way to London sitting beside a religious fanatic." He said, "What did you do before that?" I said, "I did research in theoretical astrophysics." This time his eyes glazed as he thought to himself, "What on earth does he mean by that?" But he asked me the question lots of people have asked me over the years, "How can you be a scientist and a Christian?" With the subtitle, "With Integrity," I think. And that's all I want to talk about today, because my sense in my own life is that science has not buried God. It's posed questions to God, some of which are difficult and continue to be difficult, but the majority of which have been fruitful both to my excitement with science and my excitement with the Christian faith. And that's the kind of thing that is around at the moment. In 1987, Stephen Hawking published A Brief History of Time, sold 10 million copies worldwide. Hawking himself became a cult personality. We know that because he appeared on The Simpsons and Star Trek The Next Generation, and even Specsaver adverts. That's the height of popularity in Western culture. And of course, in recent times, Hawking's grand design made it to the front page of the Times, where the headline was, "There is no God." In fact, Hawking's book in 1987, not too different from Grand Design, was prefaced by a foreword by Carl Sagan. Sagan, an American astrophysicist and atheist, said, "This is a book about God, or perhaps about the absence of God." Is that what science is about the absence of God? Well, actually, not just Carl Sagan. There are other scientists saying different things. Paul Davis, another cosmologist, over 20, 30 years has written books about how the science itself is pushing him to encounter a deeper story to the universe. What's interesting about Paul is that he's not a Christian, he's not a member of a faith community in any way, but he's able to write, partly tongue-in-cheek, but partly seriously, "In my opinion, science offers a surer path to God than religion. An absence of God, a surer path to God." I've got 20 minutes to talk about the origin of the universe and to convince you that for me, scientists are asking questions which don't prove the existence of God but open up the question in a very fruitful way of the existence of God. And therefore, I've got 20 minutes to introduce you to the universe, the Big Bang, and theological questions. Are you ready to go quickly? Because that's what we'll need to do. Quick introduction to the universe. This is an iconic photograph now. This is the Hubble Space Telescope, and it's a picture of the Hubble Ultra Deep Field. And the Hubble Ultra Deep Field shows some of the furthest objects we've ever seen in the universe. The light from some of these galaxies has taken about 13 billion years to reach us. They are 13 billion light years away. By comparison, the light from the Sun takes about 8 minutes to reach here. From these galaxies, it's taken 13 billion years. And so as you look out into your universe, you see a universe which is huge. It's big, as Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy said, really big. You just won't believe how vastly, mind-bogglingly big it is. You thought it was a long way down the road to a chemist, but that's just peanuts to space. Each of these galaxies contains about 100 billion stars. And we know that there are roughly about 100 billion stars in the universe. galaxies in the universe. So how many stars are there in the universe? I know it's a lunchtime, but it's a very easy calculation. You multiply 100 billion by 100 billion, and the answer is a lot. That's something like the number of grains of sand on the beaches of the world, if you want to begin to think about that. And of course, as you look out into the universe, you look back in time, because you see these galaxies as they were when the light set off 13 billion years ago. In fact, if we were to draw it as a diagram, here we are looking out into the universe. That photograph that I've just shown you is this section here in terms of the history of the universe, the Hubble Ultra Deep Field, and you're looking back to within a billion years of the Big Bang. Some people say, will we ever be able to get right back to the Big Bang? Well, not quite. Unfortunately, round about here, the universe becomes very cloudy and you can't see very much further. I've already introduced the term Big Bang. The Big Bang says that some 13.7 billion years ago, everything that I've shown you, those stars in galaxies, the whole lot of it was small enough to fit through the eye of a needle. At that point, the universe began in our current model of what we say is the Big Bang. On the next slide, what I've attempted to do is draw the history of the universe on one slide. Forgive me for being so bold in this. Our present age, we think, is 13.7 billion years. Some of us feel it more than others at times. And our current models of physics allow us, we think, to describe what the universe was like as we go back in time. So we think we can describe what the universe was like when it was only 1 million years old. This isn't a scale, by the way. In fact, we think we know what the universe was like when it was only 1 second old. If that isn't sufficient, we think we know what the universe was like when it was 10 to the minus 43 of a second old. If you're not a mathematician, that's a shorthand way of writing 1 divided by 10 followed by 42 zeroths of a second old. At that point, our laws of physics break down as we have them at the moment, and we can't go any further. However, the universe at this moment in its history is very, very small. It begins to expand rapidly, 10 to the minus 35 of a second. Quarks appear in the universe. These are the building blocks of protons and neutrons. Protons and neutrons get together and we see hydrogen and helium being formed between 1 second and 1,000 seconds. And then, to cut a very long story short, stars and galaxies condense out of these vast clouds of hydrogen gas. Now you might say, how do you know that's true? As the Lord said to Job in the Old Testament, where were you when I laid the foundations of the world? You could say the same thing to scientists. And of course, science at this level is a bit like a murder mystery. When Miss Marple comes onto the scene of the crime, she hasn't seen the crime happen. What she does is look for various clues or pieces of evidence to reconstruct what actually happened. And that's some of the evidence for the Big Bang. We haven't got time to go into it in detail today. More recent evidence has confirmed this. This is the sky in a form of radiation called the microwave background radiation, taken by this satellite, the Wilkinson Microwave Anisotropy Probe. And this has told us a great deal more about the universe. It's confirmed broadly our picture of the Big Bang. But it's also said that there are certain things that science at the moment we're still struggling with. For example, we know there's a lot of matter in the universe, about 23%, which is dark. We don't know what it is. And if that's not embarrassing, then another 73% of the universe is the form of something called dark energy. And we don't know what that is. Again, you don't have to be a great mathematician to know that that means that we actually only know what 4% of the universe is made of. You might say, well, have you the nerve to stand up here and talk about the science of the universe if you only know what 4% is made of? Well, at least we know we only know what 4% is made of. However, there's one other problem with the Big Bang, and that is this problem of the breaking down of the laws of physics at 10 to the minus 43 of a second. Why is it that we can't go any further? And the reason for that is that two of the great theories of 20th century physics, cosmology as expressed both in general relativity and quantum theory, don't fit together. And what Hawking and others are trying to do is to extend the story back through 10 to the minus 43 by putting these two things together into a quantum theory of gravity. However, as you might imagine, for scientists, the fact that our laws of physics break down is very frustrating. In this quote from Robert Jastrow, an astrophysicist, you get the sense of frustration. Sorry about the sexist language, this was written a few years ago. He says, for the scientist who's lived by his faith in the power of reason, the story ends like a bad dream. He scaled the mountains of ignorance. He's about to conquer the highest peak. And as he pulls himself over the final rock, he's greeted by a band of theologians who've been sitting there for centuries. Now, is that right or not? That's what I want to explore. Just before I do that, let me just acknowledge that as part of the Christian Church, the Christian Church does have disagreements about the first chapter of Genesis. There are some who say that the first chapter of Genesis is meant to be read as a scientific textbook, and therefore the universe is not billions of years old, but only 6,000 years old. There are other Christians equally committed to the authority of the Bible who say that the first chapter of Genesis is not meant as a scientific textbook. It's a theological text or a song of worship. The writer is far more concerned about catching us up in excitement of who God is rather than the particular science of how he did it. Now, for what it's worth, my own position is the second one of those, but there'll be others here who will have a divergence of opinion with me. Sometimes the Christian church has got itself so wrapped up in the conversation, however, on 6,000 years or 13 billion years, that it's lost some of the bigger picture. Galileo once famously said, the scriptures are meant to tell us how to go to heaven, not how the heavens go. And we sometimes lose that sense. But also, I think we've lost at times the questions that have been asked, both by those with religious faith and without religious faith, which stem out of the science. Let me share four areas of that with you. The questions raised by cosmology. The first is the question of origins. Or to put it bluntly, does the Big Bang prove God? Or you might have heard the question down the pub, which goes, if the universe began with a Big Bang, then who lit the blue touch paper? Who started the whole thing off? To put it in a different way, instead of a question mark here, shouldn't this be God? God's the one who starts it all off. And Pope Pius XII and an Oxford mathematician called E.A. Milne both argued for a proof of God on this kind of basis. I have to say I'm sceptical of this. I'm sceptical of this because of the logic of it. Richard Dawkins in The God Delusion quite rightly says, if you say God is the creator of the universe and you use cause and effect on the way back, then what's to stop you saying, and who created God? The same question that kids at junior school ask you as well. But more importantly for me as a Christian, this argument runs two main dangers. The first is what Charles Coulson called the God of the gaps. And that is, if science has a gap in it, beware of inserting God as the explanation into the gap. Because as science progressively explains more and more of its own area, so God is pushed out to become irrelevant. The second problem of this argument is it often gives us a deistic view of God. Now, the deists believed in a God who lit the blue touch paper of the Big Bang and then went off for a cup of tea, not to have anything more to do with it. But that's not how Christians understand the Creator God. Christians say that the God of the Bible is not the one who simply reaches out his hand and lights the blue touch paper. He's the one who holds the universe in the palm of his hand, keeping it in existence moment by moment. The God of the Bible is not that kind of God who smashes a champagne bottle against the hull of the universe and pushes it out to sea, saying, cheerio, folks, see you on Judgment Day. The God of the Bible is the one who keeps the whole thing afloat. So Paul writes to a group of Christians in Colossae and says, in him all things hold together or cohere. The God of Scripture is the one who interacts with the universe not just at 10 to the minus 43 of a second, but at every moment in the universe's history, keeping it in existence. And therefore, when Hawking and others come along and say, I'm going to fill in the first 10 to the minus 43 of a second to describe how the blue touch paper was lit, I'm quite open and relaxed about that, because it's simply filling in another bit of the story. Let me use an illustration. I don't know if any of you watch EastEnders here, but I could ask you the question. What was happening as you were watching EastEnders on the television? If you had a good enough memory, you could give a complete description from beginning to end of what happened. The opening music, this scene, that storyline, eventually what's called in the trade the dumph, dumph, dumph moment, and then the closing credits. You could give a complete description from beginning to end of what happened as you were watching EastEnders on the television. However, you could have said something different. In answer to the question, what was happening as you were watching EastEnders on the television, you could have said, behind the screen, a complex series of magnets and electron guns were keeping the picture in existence. I don't know if you would have said that, but you could have said that. Now, what a number of us as scientists are quite relaxed about is that we may be able to tell the story of the universe and fill in every part of that. But God is the one who sustains every moment of that story, keeping everything in existence. You may say, well, you've gone away from science, haven't you? Well, not quite. You say, I think, does the Big Bang prove God? My answer is no. But we're left with a question, what's the origin of the laws of physics? That's not God of the gaps, because science assumes that the laws are there rather than explains where they come from. And for me, a big question is, where do the laws of physics come from? Second question is the question of purpose. And this is the other argument they hear down the pub. It goes, the Bible tells me that the universe was the sovereign act of God. Science tells me that the universe came about through a quantum fluctuation leading to a Big Bang. And then people pause and say, now which are you going to choose? And indeed, I think Professor Dawkins' own position is that once I've got a scientific description of the event, that's all I need. It seems to me that that's too simplistic. Let's again use an illustration. What is a kiss? Well, a kiss is the approach of two pairs of lips, the reciprocal transmission of carbon dioxide and microbes, and the juxtaposition of two orbicular muscles in a state of contraction. That is a kiss in scientific terms. But if I go to my wife when I next see her and say to her, Alison, I'd love to get together with you for a mutual transmission of carbon dioxide and microbes. Let me juxtapose my orbicular muscle in a state of contraction with yours. She would say, get lost. Or to translate that, such a scientific description is true but not appropriate in this context. You see, with my wife, I want to talk about a kiss in terms of meaning, value, purpose. Which is the true definition of a kiss? Is it the one about carbon dioxide and microbes, or is it the one about purpose, meaning, value? Actually, both are true, but different. And to fully understand what a kiss is about, I need both. So again, a number of us as scientists are quite happy to accept the scientific story of what's going on as the best model of what we've got, but to say that doesn't answer every question about the universe that we have. There are questions of meaning, value, and purpose. So does the Big Bang disprove God? No, I don't think it does. But we're left with the question, why is there something rather than nothing? Something the philosophers have known is a question for a very long time. The third area is the question of design. And that is the sense, is there anything about the universe that might point us towards God? Now, people 200 years ago talked about proofs of the existence of God from the universe. I don't think that's possible. But I think for some there are pointers. Pointers like anthropic balances, or what Paul Davis in his most recent book calls the Goldilocks enigma. Why is it that things are just right to make possible carbon-based intelligent life? I could go on for hours just about this one topic, but let me give you an illustration. Imagine we had a universe-making machine, very easy to construct. Two dials on it. One would control the Big Bang force, the thing that pushes everything apart. The other would be the gravitational force, the thing that pulls everything together. Set these two dials to whatever you want and press the start button and see what kind of universe you make. The only trouble is, after a few billion goes, you'd find this is a very boring experiment indeed, because it matters what these two things are set to. If you get the Big Bang force just a bit too big. The universe expands too quickly. That structure like stars, planets, galaxies, human beings can't form. If you get the gravitational force just a touch too high, the universe appears but then immediately collapses in on itself. In the opposite of a Big Bang, a big crunch, you don't get a universe at all. In order to get a universe like ours, these need to be balanced to one part in 10 to the power 60. That's as if you're blindfolded, given a bow and arrow, turned round and round and round, and then asked to hit a target 1 centimeter squared on the other side of the universe. If you don't get that just right, we don't get a universe like ours. Don't get me wrong, I'm not saying therefore God, but I am saying for Paul Davis and others, these balances are so extraordinary, they begin to say, is there a deeper story to the universe? And then in intelligibility of the universe, Albert Einstein once said, the most incomprehensible thing about the universe is that it's comprehensible. Why is it that our minds should resonate with the mathematics of the universe in such an extraordinary way? John Polkinghorne and other scientists say that the only convincing reason for them is that God is the source of both the rationality of our minds and the rationality of the universe. What about this sense of awe? For lots of scientists, science is a very boring and tedious business. But there are moments when you see the beauty of the universe, or underneath the complexity, its simplicity and elegance, and you go, wow, look at that. Pointers for some. For me as a Christian, they're entirely consistent with a God who creates a universe to bring forth life, therefore it should be anthropically balanced, who is the source of the rationality of the universe and inspires awe. One last thing, and then I'll finish. And that's the question of revelation. Because you may say, okay, I get the kiss thing. I go with the science and faith held together. I see that there may be pointers for some of some deeper story. But how do you get to the God bit? After all, you've talked about science and its evidence. Does the God bit only happen as you kind of throw your brain away and just have faith? As Richard Dawkins says with his at times characteristic humility, faith is a great cop-out. The great excuse to evade the need to think and evaluate evidence. Is that what Christian faith is about? No, I don't think it is. I mean, if God is the creator of the universe, he must be infinite. Our minds are finite. And people then have said, how can the finite mind ever understand the infinite God? That's a fair point. But says the Christian, what if the infinite God decided to reveal himself to the finite mind in a way that the finite mind could understand? That seems to me to be a logical possibility. In fact, for the Christian faith, it's right at the heart of the Christian claim that the infinite creator God has revealed himself in a way that we can understand. And the Bible says that God has done this in many and various ways, but supremely in his Son Jesus. That's been my own story of Christian faith. I didn't come to believe in God by looking at the heavens. I came to God at the age of 17 as I read the stories of Jesus from the New Testament. And there in the life, death and resurrection of Jesus, I found no other explanation than this was God himself walking the pages of space-time history. That's how I encountered the Creator God. And the wonderful thing is I still encounter him in the Jesus who's risen from the dead. Well, I've had more than enough of my time, Marcus. I need to stop so that we can have some question, answer and criticism and comment. Thank you very much.
We're just going to do this hands in the air to save time in terms of writing down questions. Let's take just 5 or 10 minutes. Who wants to get the ball rolling?
There have been claims that the speed of light... The question is, some people have asked or claimed that the speed of light is not constant. And is that necessarily right? There have been claims that the speed of light varies with time. Some who've taken a 6-day creationist view have argued that the speed of light decreases quite rapidly. And this explains why distant galaxies, which appear to be very far away, in fact, are not. I've looked at those papers and I'm not convinced. There are some more recent scientific papers on the way that certain constants in the universe may vary with time. And this is a new area, and we're still beginning to figure out quite how we're able to test that. But the basic assumption is that certain laws of physics, like the speed of light, are constant wherever the universe is. And the vast majority of evidence is pretty much still on that side. I mean, there is a sense in which the Genesis account does start with light, in the same way that very early in the universe's history, light is liberated. And so there are interesting resonances between the two accounts. I myself am quite hesitant about mapping the scientific story too closely on the Genesis story. Some people have tried to do this, for instance, in biological evolution, and identify the movement from simplicity to complexity. And broadly, that's the case. But there are problems. It doesn't quite fit. And so, for instance, you have night and day before the creation of the sun and the moon, which is an obvious example. And it's things like that that, for me, suggest that the writer isn't primarily interested in telling us a scientific story. He's primarily interested in telling us who God is. It's a good point, and it's a point which is linked to something very sexy in the world of physics, and that is the belief in many universes. So the argument goes, if there are many different universes where the laws of physics are very different, then there wouldn't be observers to see the coincidences that we see in our universe. However, I inserted into that argument, if there are many universes. And the question of the existence of many universes is quite controversial, both in terms of A, whether they exist, and B, whether we can know that they exist. Because at the moment, it seems difficult to pass information from one universe to another. Now, if you can't pass information from one universe to another, how do you actually know it's there? You can speculate about it philosophically, but it's not easy as a scientific explanation of the fine-tuning. But I think your point is right, and that's why I want to be very clear that you cannot use the fine-tuning of the universe, the anthropic balances, as a proof for the existence of God, because there's a possibility of many universes as an alternative theory. But it's still an extraordinary pointer, saying that there's something deeper than just this universe going on. Yes, I mean, I think so, and indeed I hope so, because at the heart of the universe, physics teaches you that there is, or one hopes, that there's something which is simple and elegant and beautiful, which coheres in the laws of physics. And the anthropic balances, I think, will have scientific explanations. But that doesn't take away the fact that they are extremely striking as indicators of the importance of human beings and intelligent-based life in this universe. And there I'm back to the kiss, where I can have the scientific explanation of something, but that doesn't rule out me asking questions of meaning and value and purpose. So I don't want to take God of the gaps into, it must be God who's designed the universe exactly like this, and try and prove God through that. So yeah. It's really crass of a speaker at this point to say, well, actually, I've just written a book about that. And I'm really sorry to do that. Not on angels, but certainly on the resurrection. As it's coming up to Christmas, the book is called Christian Eschatology in the Physical Universe. And what I do in that is try and look not at the beginning of the universe, but the end of the universe. And particularly explore this thing in the resurrection accounts of Jesus. It seems to me that the gospel writers are representing a Jesus who is real in the present, but no longer limited by dimensions of space and time as he was before the crucifixion. So he appears in rooms with locked doors. There's something about him that they don't immediately recognize. There's a whole series of clues within the resurrection accounts. And the picture that I build is as you've described it, and that is to say, perhaps the three dimensions of space and one dimension of time are only a small part of what is reality. Now, in physics, and particularly with Hawking's work and others on M theory and string theory, a whole number of others, we actually now believe that there must be between 10 and 26 dimensions of space-time. So that gives us a model to begin to talk about many-dimensional spaces. And I think that's very fruitful in thinking about the relationship, not just of the resurrection to the physical universe, but also God's relationship overall to the physical universe.
I think we'll have to leave it there. Maybe just one last question.
My own experience, and it's within physics, and there may be a distinction between physics and biology these days. In the department where I worked in and continue to have very close relationship with, 25% of the research scientists would be Christians. Another 50% at least would be open to religious faith, and a very small proportion would be atheists. However, you go down to undergraduates, if I can say go down to undergraduates, and there amongst undergraduates you have far more who would be atheists or those who embody scientism, the belief that science and religion are in conflict. I think within biology there's a slightly different picture these days. Biology is still living in the legacy of the post-Darwinian controversies and the sense of fear and suspicion between faith and science. But in the global surveys that have been done, and I know Dawkins represents different figures in his God Delusion books, but the ones that I'm most familiar with, is that the surveys that were done at the turn of the 20th century and then the turn of the 21st century show between 45 and 50% of scientists as believers in a creator God. And that actually been affected very little by the 100 years in between. Now, of course, for someone like Paul Davis, you've got there someone who's intrigued by questions of God but not part of a faith community. So when people say they believe in God, you've got to nuance that a little bit, but that's my experience.
Unfortunately, our time has gone. It's a shame we can't take the afternoon off work and have more.